This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. He's declared that Iran has joined the club of nuclear countries. He's called for Israel to be wiped off the map of the Middle East. And he's privately said that he and President Bush are engaged in a game of chicken, but Iran won't be the one to back down. Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is the subject of a new biography by my guest Khosra Naji. It's called Ahmadinejad, The Secret History of Iran's Radical Leader. Khosra Naji grew up in Iran and received his college education in England, where he now lives. He's reported from Iran for CNN, the BBC, the Los Angeles Times, and other publications. He currently works for the BBC's Persian service. Khosra Naji, welcome to Fresh Air. What are some of the ways in which you see Ahmadinejad as a break from the past? Why is he considered extreme even by Iranian standards?
He comes from the extreme right wing in the political spectrum, in fact, the fringe right wing of the political spectrum. He's reaching power basically represents to me a sea change in the politics of Iran, a change of regime, if you like, in a sense that he represents a loose alliance of important sections of Iran's Revolutionary Guards, also young hardline clergymen in Iran, and also the younger generation, younger members of Islamic right-wingers in Iran, who I call them Iran's neoconservatives. And he's got important backing from major centers of power in Iran, including Iran's supreme leader. What these people did in effect by coming to power the way they did was basically wresting control from the old guard of the revolution. And the old guard basically wanted to put the revolution behind them. They wanted to look forward. They wanted to improve the economy, to turn this experiment in Iran as a model of success of an Islamic state. But the new people, Ahmadinejad and his supporters who are in power today, they don't want that. They want to go back to the revolution. They want to reignite the revolution and their ideology. They are idealists, right-wing idealists who think Islam and the Shiite brand of Islam should spread its word across the world. They want to conquer the world. They want to spread the word of the revolution
to all four corners of the world. Is that a break from the past? Because you're right that, you know, Ahmadinejad believes Iran has to be militarily powerful, and that the survival of the revolution at home depends on spreading it abroad. So is that something new for Iran?
It's not new in a sense that Ayatollah Khomeini, at the height of the Iranian revolution, had the same sort of ideas. But he didn't push them as hard as Ahmadinejad has. And basically, that idea fell to the wayside, if you like. And Iran was entangled in a very costly and bloody war with Iraq. And all those things got forgotten, basically. And after the war, the priority, if you like, was to rebuild the country and rebuild the economy. So those ideas were put aside in favor of rebuilding the country. Ahmadinejad is saying the same things, but pursuing it now at the time that Iran has done its rebuilding and was looking forward to reduced tension with its neighbors to the outside world under President Khatami and before him under President Rafsanjani. And now with Ahmadinejad, there's a complete break with that. Now these people, the ones in power, they want to make sure that Iran militarily is very strong and that they believe also that in order to survive internally, this ideology has to be spread across the world, particularly in the Islamic world and in the region, to be able to survive.
So where does nuclear weapons fit into Ahmadinejad's vision for Iran and its ability to not only protect itself but spread its vision?
Ahmadinejad, of course, like other Iranian leaders, they repeatedly say that they have no intentions of going for nuclear arms in Iran. But Ahmadinejad, at the same time, in many of his speeches, has been saying that Iran has joined the nuclear club of nations. My own impression, and there are many people in Tehran who believe this, they believe that Iran is basically striving to arrive at that point whereby it can, if it wants to, produce nuclear weapons when and if it's needed. And by that, they're hoping the balance of power will change and Americans and Israelis will stop threatening Iraq.
Let me read the last sentence in your book about Ahmadinejad. You say, Ahmadinejad is on a mission to change the world and not just Iran, and he's ready for a battle if need be. You say he isn't afraid of using force. Do you think he's pushing for a battle? Do you think he wants a battle?
No, but... People who have been close to him and who have heard him speak in inner circles of the government in Iran have heard him say in their meetings that in his belief, Iran and the United States are going to come to blows sooner or later, and Iran has to prepare itself for it. So that's the mentality, and that if you think that is going to happen sooner or later, I would have thought you would be sort of working on preparing yourself for that. Having said all this, he also on the record as having said that he would like to be the person who can unlock the relations between the United States and Iran. But that is part of the ambition, the ambitions of this man, in a sense that he knows or he thinks that it's not possible to do this. But if it was possible, he would like to be the person who does this. So in a sense, all those preparations in Iran today are basically preparing for the day that this might happen, and this new group of people in power today are called the militarists. They want to militarize the country, and the threats from the United States and from Israel gives them a good excuse to carry on with that work.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Khosra Naji, and he is a journalist with the BBC World Service in the Persian service. And he is the author of the new book, Ahmadinejad, The Secret History of Iran's Radical Leader. Ahmadinejad has said some pretty extreme and very hateful things about Israel. What are some of the most extreme things he said?
Well, wiping off Israel off the map is pretty extreme. Also, his government holding a conference of Holocaust deniers in Tehran was pretty extreme and off the charts. He's said many things. His letter, for example, to Chancellor Merkel of Germany is incredibly staggering in its naivete and its lack of judgment. The letter basically, he wrote a personal letter to Chancellor Merkel saying that Germany has been wronged in the Second World War, and it's time for Iran and Germany to forge an alliance against all those countries who were the victors of the Second World War.
And he also proposed that Germany and Austria give up some of their provinces to create a new Zionist state so that Israel could be dismantled and moved.
Oh, he said many things on that front, including a sentence. I think he said during a press conference at an Islamic conference, he said that Jews have to be sent to Alaska, something to that effect, which is pretty outrageous. Even in Iran, many people were angered by these statements, and many people said openly in Iran that this is not the way a president should speak, and there's no reason why he should involve himself with the issue of Holocaust, and all those statements that he's made are generally to the undermining Iran's position in the world. But he, undaunted, he carried on and he said more of the same things, and occasionally he still repeats those things.
What has he done to threaten Israel beyond rhetoric, such as increasing money for Hezbollah?
Hezbollah is very close to Iran. Iran very close to Hezbollah. Of course, the relationship is pretty strong. There are allegations that Iran sends arms and missiles to Hezbollah, but those remain to be proved. The relationship with Hamas is pretty close. I remember I went to a conference in Tehran of all the hardline Islamic Palestinian groups who were gathered in Tehran. And during that conference, Iran promised to give Hamas $50 million.
Hezbollah is expanding its power in Beirut. Hezbollah seized control of western Beirut on Friday. Do you think that Ahmadinejad has anything to do with that?
Iran supports Hezbollah and supports Hezbollah's policy within Lebanon. And these days, with the recent fighting in Lebanon, I note that Iranian media that are supporting the hardliners in Iran are pretty sort of happy with the way Hezbollah has behaved in Beirut, and they see that as an action by the people of Lebanon. I remember one headline which read in one of the newspapers, people of Beirut are in control of Beirut, something like that, projecting Hezbollah as representative of the people of the whole of the capital.
There's a poster that you mentioned that Ahmadinejad put up while he was mayor of Tehran before he became the president of Iran. And I think this poster probably gives some insights into Ahmadinejad's values. Would you describe the poster? It's the suicide bomber poster.
That's right. It's a poster of one of the suicide bombers in Israel, a Palestinian lady who apparently blew herself up in one of the attacks in Jerusalem, I think it was. This picture of this lady is put up at a very busy intersection in Tehran. A huge poster. You're talking about some 12 meters times, 6 meters, that kind of a thing. And this poster shows this lady holding her baby in one hand and a Kalashnikov in another hand. And the baby is holding a grenade, basically, in his hand. And the idea is that Ahmadinejad, when he was the mayor of Tehran, wanted this to be the model for Iranian women. And at the top, it says, it's a quotation from the lady, who says that, "I love children. I love my children very much, but I love martyrdom better," something to that effect. And this has been held up as a model for Iranian women. And this is at the very busy intersection in the capital, Tehran. And that gave an idea of where Ahmadinejad's values lay, in effect, and where he wants to take the country. This whole business of militarization and this belief in jihad, in martyrdom, something that is alien to any culture, really. But this is being forced down on the Iranians, or was forced down and is still being forced down on Iran and the Iranians by leaders who are close to President Ahmadinejad today.
My guest is journalist Khosra Naji. His new book is called Ahmadinejad, The Secret History of Iran's Radical Leader. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Khosra Naji, and he's a journalist with the BBC Persian Service. That's part of the BBC's World Service. And he's written a new book called Ahmadinejad, The Secret History of Iran's Radical Leader. Hillary Clinton promised massive retaliation if Iran attacked Israel. And she said in the next 10 years, during which they might foolishly consider launching an attack on Israel, we would be able to totally obliterate them. Do you have any idea how that played in Iran, how much coverage that got in Iran?
It did get coverage in Iran, and so far as I know, the Iranian authorities have taken this and complained to the UN Security Council, complaining about this statement of Senator Clinton. I listened to it, and I thought it was way over the top. I thought this was a hypothetical question regarding a very sort of unlikely scenario that Iran might attack Israel with a nuclear weapon, and what would the United States do? And she replies, "We will obliterate Iran," which was pretty. I thought it was pretty sad. It was at the other side of the coin of President Ahmadinejad, if you like. Ahmadinejad says, "We will wipe out Israel off the map, wipe Israel off the map." And Senator Clinton says much the same thing in a way that she lumps together some 70 million Iranians with Ahmadinejad as one entity and then threatens to obliterate a whole nation, which is pretty sad.
To understand Ahmadinejad, you have to understand his religious beliefs. And it sounds like his religious beliefs are on the extreme side of Islam. Tell us about his spiritual advisor.
His spiritual advisor is a senior clergyman, an ayatollah who sits in Rome by the name of Ayatollah Mesbah Yazdi. He's pretty right-wing, on the extreme right-wing of the political spectrum in Iran and in the Islamic spectrum. He has no time, if you like, for democracy, for the role of people in a democracy, votes of the people, anything of that sort. This spiritual guide, if you like, comes from the same flock of people in Iran who, after the revolution, listened to a philosopher in Tehran by the name of Ahmad Fardid. He was a disciple himself, was a disciple of Martin Heidegger, who was a philosophy professor in Germany, carrying a membership card of the National Socialist Party in Germany. So altogether, it's all a very right-wing political philosophy, if you like. In this philosophy, there's no time for democracy, for human rights, for elections, for any of those things that we believe in a sense, in a democratic society.
So he sees an Islamic society as not being about democracy. The people don't get to elect their leaders. The spiritual leader believes what? That who appoints the leaders?
This is it. There's debate as to what he actually means by it. He believes that a strong leader is needed, and that strong leader could be an ayatollah, a senior ayatollah who would be the representative of God on earth, and he would be able to lead the country. And the people's role is basically to support that person, and ballot boxes, all these things are alien to this culture.
But obviously Ahmadinejad has no problem running for mayor and serving in that position, running for president and serving in that position, even though his spiritual leader doesn't even believe in the ballot box.
That's right. Well, the system that has been put in place in Iran by Ayatollah Khomeini at the beginning of the revolution in 1979 is still there. And people like Ahmadinejad at least have to pay lip service to that system until they destroy it. They haven't destroyed it for the moment. They have to pay lip service to elections, to parliament. They have to go to elections. And as president, he has to get elected.
So I think what you're saying is as long as the Islamic extremists are the ones elected, they're okay with voting. But if they're not, there would be more attacks against the democratic system.
That's right. I mean, so long as they can make the elections work for them, then they can go along because it's not going to bother them as much because they're going to be in power. Don't forget that the idea that this group of people who are today in power, they were in opposition for many, many years. They had a really bad time in the opposition. Now that they've got control of power, they're not going to let it go, no matter what. So in the elections are becoming more and more irrelevant because there are so many irregularities, cheatings, and all sorts of legitimate and illegitimate means are used to basically bring out of the hat the people they would like to see elected.
Khosra Naji is the author of the new book Ahmadinejad, The Secret History of Iran's Radical Leader. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Khosra Naji, the author of the new book Ahmadinejad, The Secret History of Iran's Radical Leader. Naji grew up in Iran and has reported from there for the BBC, CNN, the LA Times, and other publications. He's now at the BBC's Persian service. Well, getting back to Ahmadinejad's religious views, he believes in the return of the Mahdi. Describe what that means. Is that like a second coming?
That's right. In Shiite Islam, the 12th Imam is gone missing. He went missing some 800 years ago as a child with the promise to come back one day to establish peace and justice on earth. Many people in Iran, many Muslims, many Shiites around the world take that as an abstract idea that eventually justice will prevail in this world. So there's no literal belief in that somebody is going to come tomorrow and, you know, things are going to change. But for Ahmadinejad and people like him and close to him, they belong to a sect within Shiaism that believes and reveres the missing Imam, the Mahdi. He believes that Mahdi is going to come sooner than many people think, and that we have to prepare for that, and we don't have time too much to think about this or that subject or this or that policy. We have to do things, we have to carry out things and prepare ourselves. And Ahmadinejad has been on the record actually saying to various people that he believes that by the end of his term in office, the Mahdi will return and he has to hand over power to the Mahdi. And only a few days ago, he said in a speech in northeast Iran that in his belief, the Mahdi is managing the affairs of the state, and he is only doing the legwork, if you like. He is representing the Mahdi, but Mahdi is in charge, and Mahdi is managing the affairs. And this raised to complaints and statements from others, including some senior religious leaders in Iran, who said that this shouldn't be the case. We shouldn't bring the name of Mahdi into the political world here, because people will see that if anything goes wrong here, that and many things are going wrong in Iran, and they blame the Mahdi for it. And this cannot be done. This shouldn't be done. The president shouldn't go around talking about Mahdi being in charge and all this.
Yeah, so Ahmadinejad basically thinks he's got God's ear.
He thinks he's the chosen one. He thinks he's on a mission, and he has no time. He has to push, and he has to change things, and that has colored his ideas about the domestic politics, about the economy, all that, and also with his foreign policy, in a sense that this belief has given him this idea that the status quo is not acceptable and things have to change. I can understand why some people abroad feel particularly concerned to see a person like him who might have his finger on the nuclear trigger soon, speaking like, you know, the end of time is close.
Well, in this belief that the lost Mati is going to be returning to Earth, is that an end times theology where when he returns, the world ends?
Well, he's supposed to come back with Jesus, in fact, as a disciple, and they are going to basically establish peace and justice throughout the world, change the world in a sense that, you know, there will be peace and justice everywhere. So that's the idea, and it's not just particular to Shiite Muslims. You know, you have Christians who believe Jesus is going to come soon and is going to establish peace and justice throughout the world. So Shiites, and particularly people like Ahmadinejad, particularly believe literally in his return and his return pretty soon.
Members of the Bush administration have accused Iran of waging a proxy war in Iraq against the United States. And the United States, the Bush administration, has accused Iran of training Iraqi militias and helping to arm them. What do you have that you could tell us about Ahmadinejad's association with Iraqi militias?
I don't know much, actually. I remember in Tehran, when I was in Tehran, I met the Iraqi foreign minister who had come to Tehran to urge Iran to stop supporting various Shiite groups in Iraq and support the government instead. So there is that evidence, too, from the Iraqi government, in a sense. But at the same time, don't forget, Iran wants a calm and united Iraq next door. A breakup of Iraq is not in the interest of Iran. Iran doesn't want a separate Kurdish entity in the north or a Sunni entity in the middle or even a Shiite entity in the south. And all of this is going to help worsen the situation, push Iraq into a civil war, and if there is a civil war in Iraq, then there is a possibility that Iran will be sucked in support of the Shiites, while all the other Arab countries will support the Sunnis in Iraq. Iran doesn't want to see all this.
So do you think that the United States could actually work with Ahmadinejad, or do you think Ahmadinejad, you know, in terms of creating a more peaceful Iraq, or do you think that Ahmadinejad is impossible to work with because he's so extreme and odd?
It's difficult to say, actually. He's also, as you say, difficult, odd, and extreme in many ways, but he's also unpredictable. When you push the rhetoric to the point of no return, of course, you know, there is a cost associated to this. But at the same time, we've seen it in history, this kind of rhetoric can be turned around. And I wouldn't put it past Mr. Ahmadinejad to sit at a table for a direct negotiations and direct talks with the United States.
And this is just speculation, but do you think, like, if the United States launched an attack against Iran's nuclear facility or facilities, do you think that that would be playing into Ahmadinejad's hand because he wants to militarize Iran, or do you think that that would weaken him?
I think already is playing into the hands of Ahmadinejad and his supporters in terms of militarizing the country. The threats, every time there is a talk of military action against Iran, this plays into their hands to militarize Iran further and have excuses to limit freedoms within the country and push for a more authoritarian regime in Iran, which they are doing. In the eventuality, if there is going to be an attack, in my view, Iran being a very nationalistic country, people sort of, you know, are proud of their historical independence. And even if they don't have time for Ahmadinejad or the hardliners, I think a threat from outside the country is going to be seen as an aggression against the country, and it would mobilize the people of Iran against the aggressor.
Is there an example that you can think of that we haven't yet discussed of an Ahmadinejad policy that strikes you as being particularly odd and also revealing of who the man is?
He wrote a letter to President Bush. One of the things he said, which was odd to me, was that he argued that Western liberalism has come to an end and the world is ready for Islam and all this. And it struck me as odd in a sense that this man has got a PhD in traffic, transport. For him to speak about Western liberalism as a school of thought, as a philosophy, coming to an end, and for somebody who hasn't traveled abroad, who hasn't seen the West, who hasn't lived in Western countries, to say this was indicative how naive he is, how full of himself he is, in a sense, and how wrong he is about the world outside.
Well, Khosrow Naji, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Khosrow Naji is the author of Ahmadinejad, The Secret History of Iran's Radical Leader. Deborah Jacobs entered a different world when she married the Palestinian diplomat who became Yasser Arafat's senior advisor and spokesman, Marwan Khanafani. When they met, she was a Lebanese-American college student from Long Island. He was working at the UN. Deborah Khanafani's marriage, divorce, and child custody battle are the subject of her memoir, Unveiled, How an American Woman Found Her Way Through Politics, Love, and Obedience in the Middle East. The book is also about her friendships with women who were married to Arab leaders, including Sua Arafat and Queen Dina of Jordan. Deborah Khanafani has been the director of international productions for the Palestinian Broadcasting Corporation and now serves on the boards of several Israeli-Palestinian peace organizations and is involved in conflict resolution programs. She lives in New York and L.A. Deborah Khanafani, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me start with what is probably an obvious perception, which is that your ex-husband was at the forefront of what he would certainly describe as a liberation struggle, and yet he was very restrictive in what freedoms he would allow you as his wife. What are some of the things that he did not want you to do while you were married?
Well, I think basically he wanted me to disconnect from my old life and all the things that I enjoyed in my old life, including my friends and my interests. I grew up in New York City. I grew up in a home with a father that loved life. He loved being out at restaurants every night. We were always in the theater. I was in museums constantly. And this love of culture was something that my husband did not share, and certainly in terms of Western culture. And I realized later that it was something that is not uncommon among people in the Middle East, where they feel like they've been occupied by European or British countries, and they don't have this appreciation of art that comes. They see them more as the oppressor. And he didn't share that love with me for those things. And I think he felt they were a threat to him, that it meant that I wanted to live more in my old life. I think he saw this very clear distinction that I had one life before I met him, and then after I met him, I was supposed to have this other life, which revolved around him. And all the things I was supposed to leave behind, such as friendships and interests, couldn't trickle over into the new life. So even seeing a friend became very difficult. And he was very aggressive when old friends of mine would call on the phone or they would come to visit. He'd be insulting, and it would be very uncomfortable. And essentially, he would win because I wouldn't want to invite those people back or continue those relationships.
Do you see his restrictive attitude toward you as just being a sign of his personal possessiveness, or do you think it's a larger cultural issue?
I think it's both. I think that it's his own personal possessiveness, but I think he comes from a culture that allows that to happen without it seeming abnormal. And he does worry a lot in general, and he's like that with my children as well. So I know it is part of his personality. He always wants to know where everybody is and that everybody's safe. And I sort of realized why he's like that when I was writing this book. I learned things about him while writing the book, and I was able to understand that he had lost so many people in his life, close friends, his brother, his niece.
His brother was assassinated.
His brother was assassinated. His niece was also assassinated. She was in the car that was blown up with him. And looking back more at his history, I started to realize why he was driven by fear and had this control of wanting to know where everybody was and that everybody was safe.
Your husband, Marwan Kanafani, was with the Arab League when you met, but he became one of Arafat's closest advisors.
Yes.
Once he became a close advisor to Arafat, how did that change the security situation in your home?
It really didn't. There was no fear. We never had any fear. Sometimes we would get visits from the FBI who would want information about people, and we really didn't know what they were asking us. So that changed quite a bit.
You briefly lived in Ramallah. This was before the Second Intifada.
You
left just as, like, moments before that started.
Yes.
I guess I'm interested in hearing what your impressions of Ramallah were like then, when things were much more hopeful, compared to what they're like there now.
Mm. You know, somebody recently asked me if I'd want to go back there now, and I said I would really be afraid to. I think it would be devastating. When I first went to Ramallah, I was so moved by the hopefulness, by the building that was going on. Everywhere you looked, there was something new opening up. People were looking for a new life, a new way of being.
And this was shortly after the Palestinian Authority was created and Palestinians were taking control of the territories?
Exactly. It was exactly then, at that time. And foreign money was being poured into the area. I wouldn't say being poured in, but was going into the area. Expatriates were coming back. People were building houses. There were even wine stores opening up, little restaurants that were modeled after little European restaurants. There was just a fantastic mood and a very hopeful mood at the time. And now, with the wall being up and things just being destroyed and people living under curfews, it's just a whole different place now. And I think it would be very upsetting to see.
My guest is Deborah Kanafani, the author of the memoir Unveiled. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Deborah Kanafani, is the author of a memoir about marrying and divorcing Yasser Arafat's chief political advisor and spokesperson, Marwan Kanafani. Her memoir is called Unveiled: How an American Woman Found Her Way Through Politics, Love, and Obedience in the Middle East. Kanafani is an American of Lebanese descent. So you divorced in America. You were married under American law and divorced under American law.
Mm-hmm.
But then your husband moved back to the Middle East.
Yes.
Took the children with him.
Well, he didn't take them with him right away. I had the children with me all the time in the United States until they went to visit him one summer.
But then you came up against custody laws.
Yes, and that was quite a shock to me. And I really, really didn't know that I would not be permitted to have my children back. I probably should have been more familiar with those laws, but I wasn't. I figured I'm an American. He is an American citizen. I was divorced. I had these rights, and I went there assuming that I would be able to keep those rights.
Why couldn't you?
Well, because there were no reciprocal agreements, and really I was subject to the Islamic laws that ruled the West Bank.
And what were those laws pertaining to custody?
Yes, and under those laws, Once children are a certain age, I believe it's 7 years old for a girl and 9 year old, 9 years old for a boy, and that does vary from country to country, the father has the right to the child. And part of that is because they feel if the mother remarries, the worst thing would be to have a little girl living in a home with a strange man. And so that is one of the reasons that men get custody. Another reason, I believe, is just because it's an easy way to control women, because the woman cannot ask for a divorce in that country. So the woman is always told, either do what I say or I'll divorce you. And she knows that if she's divorced by this husband, that she will also lose her children. And that's a huge threat to hold over a woman, and it's used all the time.
How did you end up regaining custody of your children?
Well, while I lived there, the situation was status quo, where he did have custody of them and I could visit them. But then at the end, what happened was there was an uprising. The Intifada of 2000 happened. And my children were eventually evacuated into Jordan. And while they were there, my ex-husband had to go back into the Gaza Strip and see Arafat. So my children were left in Jordan with his new wife, who was also an American. And I begged her and begged her to send the children back to me because he refused to. She said to me, I would consider sending them, but I don't even have an American passport. He bought them here with Palestinian passports. So they had no parent, no passport. They were in a foreign country. And at that point, I called the State Department. My cousin Donna Shalala was in Clinton's cabinet. And there was one plane that was leaving the next day, and that would be the last plane out of Jordan back to the United States. And everyone worked overnight to get my children passports. And I got a call back finally in the morning that the passports had been issued and my children would be put on that plane. And my ex-husband did not know that this was taking place. So there was also that fear that he might appear back into Jordan and prevent this. So it was just nerve-wrenching until they finally got on that plane and they landed in the United States.
And what about your husband? What was his reaction when he found out that you had arranged for the children to fly to the United States and stay with you?
Well, his reaction was really denial that there was a problem that was going to be long-lasting. So he immediately told us all that, okay, this is okay, but just for a few days, I'm going to be bringing them back to the Middle East. I'm not going to help you financially so that they can be there with you. We were staying with my mother. It sort of kept us in a state of not knowing what the future would be at a time when I think my children really needed a sense of security. So that made things more difficult. And he kept calling and saying the political situation was going to blow over and everything would be fine. But yet we were watching the news every night and seeing tanks rolling in and more missiles being shot. And there was nothing to indicate that this situation was going to get any better. Finally, he admitted that perhaps the area was too dangerous to bring the children back to, and finally agreed that they could stay in the States with me and he would help us.
You're involved in conflict resolution groups, working for conflict resolution between Palestinians and Israelis in the Middle East. You're on the board of several organizations that are conflict resolution organizations. How did you get involved in conflict resolution?
Well, I've always been interested in what happens between people. I studied psychology. I am always amazed when people that can't get along finally find a common ground and things can change between them. And when I saw this in action, and it really began when I met Dr. Arafat, who was Yasser Arafat's brother, Fethi Arafat, and we became friendly, and he was holding these salons on occasion at the Palestinian Red Crescent, which is a hospital in Ramallah. And I started going to those, and I started seeing Palestinians and Israelis meeting every Sunday evening. And I saw how eager they were to learn from each other and to try and find that common ground. And then I started working with him more and more, and we started reaching out and doing these sessions on a more consistent basis. And people from all walks of life would come. And just to see the magic, there's really a magic that takes place when you see people connecting that have been told by their governments or belief systems that they're supposed to be enemies. And so I developed a great belief in the possibility of what can happen when people come together and start trying to coexist.
Where does your husband live now, your ex-husband?
My ex-husband lives in Cairo now, and I don't. As you may know, he was a soccer star in Cairo for 10 years. He was the goalie for the national team of Egypt. And being a goalie in that part of the world is, a quick road to stardom. So he is really worshipped by the people, and I think he loves being there because of that. And so after this last election, when he lost and Hamas took over, he went to Cairo. And I think he lives with a lot of disappointment about what happened to the political dreams they had. But he has spent this time writing a book about his 20 years with Arafat called Years of Hope, which just came out in Arabic. And so we both have books that have come out at the same time.
Deborah Canifani, her memoir is called Unveiled. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.